I wonder, excuse me for jumping in, but you got me thinking here, and I wonder if we've got the rider, we've got the elephant, and we've got the bee.
All right, maybe it's too many metaphors.
I'm thinking you look at the rider and the elephant kind of covers what's within the human being, but there's also something that connects us. That also is as undeniable as our urges and as undeniable as our belief that we can make decisions about what to do with the elephant. This connection, I think of it as the root of spirituality, this sense of some energy or something that connects us. You know, you look at some of these hive species, and they seem to be in communication in a way that is hard for us to understand with our individual minds.
That's right, because in a sense we are really part of a larger group, and this is one of the insights that you find in just about every spiritual tradition. The idea that that really we are all God, or God is in us, or we're just a small part. You know, Hindus say that we're all part of Brahma. So in almost any religion that has a mystical tradition, you're going to find exactly that idea, that really the individual is an illusion, that we really are part of something much larger.
Yeah, and you talk about that also. We've got a caller. We've got Vince on the line. Let's see what Vince would like to talk about. Welcome to On Your Mind.
Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Vince Clark, the Love God.
Well, how are you doing,
Vince? Listening to your show, man, your guest is fantastic.
Very good.
Thank you, Vince.
Yeah, I just wasn't clear on that third cousin thing, though. Instead of incest, wouldn't that promote inbreeding?
You share half your genes with your brother and sister, so that would be bad. You share an eighth of your genes with your cousin, so that's actually not very much, and in a lot of cultures, that's exactly who you're supposed to marry, is your first cousin. But, all right, you know, in America, we don't do that. By the time you get to second or third cousin, I can almost guarantee you that somewhere in your family, you've got people who married second and third cousins, because they're as distantly related as complete strangers.
Actually, your third cousin is your mother's first cousin's child.
Your second cousin would be your mother's first cousin.
Well, let me say this. In the book, one of the things you talk about is this sense of what does it mean to have natural selection? You know, you select for an individual person's genes, but there's also a way that you select for a group's genes to be passed along. And when you define the group, I think you sort of put that kind of second degree away as where you would probably define a single group.
Well, compatibility is not that hard to find, Steve, and you know I'm always preaching that.
You certainly are.
Basically, I liked what the doctor was saying about people worry about their bodies too much because the body is actually something that's really inanimate without the life force flowing through it. And basically, when people are compatible, it's because of the life force. It has nothing to do with the body.
Okay,
well, yeah, I would agree with that it's something which feels to us like a kind of magic because we can't really explain what it is. It is some sort of compatibility of...
I explain what it is all the time, but basically, people are hung up on their bodies. And I really enjoyed hearing you say that, man, because I know it to be true. I've been a person that's been in the battlefield and been studying just like you guys for a long time. And, I really know what's up. I can look at an individual and tell whether compatibility is there or not. It's something that the world needs to be, woke up about. Actually, we live this life, man, and we don't have a clue about what's going on.
But we think we do.
Yeah, we all think that we do. And sometimes thinking gets in the way of actually having a great life.
Okay. Thanks for calling in, Vince.
All right, and thanks, Steve.
And Jonathan, can you talk a little bit about the ways that we sort of fool ourselves into to thinking that we know something, or that it's a rational thought? I guess we talked about it a little bit before. How does it work? How do we manage to be so confused sometimes? Yeah. You quote my purported distant third cousin line, Mr. Franklin, a couple of times. And he, by the way, there's a quote I kept expecting you to come up with, where he more or less said that he believes that all of the good things that morality and the church try to teach you, you could also come to the same conclusion solely by reason, that it's sort of the enlightened self-interest idea.
Yeah, that's right. And he certainly did. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Franklin was a very unusual man in a very unusual time. I don't know that we have many paragons of reason and virtue like that
mm-hmm.
today.
Let me talk the one toughest question I wanted to ask you is, you know, when we talk about the value of social connections, and I think I have the impression, as you said before, that maybe you were surprised at how much you came to acknowledge what you called an ideology of extreme personal freedom is something to be avoided. And I guess what I want to talk about is it sounded a little bit like it was focusing on people who do that purely out of an ideology, whereas sometimes you've got people who feel ostracized, who'd like to be connected, people who maybe have deficits in social skills and drive people away without trying to. And I think in the same chapter you pointed out that there's some research about kind of how happy people are, and you found that a lot of external circumstances didn't do a good job of predicting how happy people were. People who were rich or poor weren't that far apart. People who were black or white or male or female or whatever, there wasn't that much difference. The one big difference was homeless people.
Well, that's right. Yeah, they do have a lot of problems.
Which, again, is the people who are not connected, but people who, I think, you know, you've got the old myth of the happy hobo, and I think that we don't see that too much in the homeless population.
No, that's right. Well nowadays, the homeless have so many problems with mental illness. I think the hobos of the 30s might have been different.
Mm-hmm.
But, the broader answer to your question is that there are a number of what you could call happiness traps. That is, mm-hmm. times when we pursue something, we're drawn to it, but it's bad for us. Freedom is one of those. Of course, we need some degree of freedom. I mean, we don't want to live in a dictatorship or be chained to a wall. But many people feel like, oh, you know, let me change the city I live in, change the relationship I'm in. You know, I need to be free. Let me move to a better job.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you do that, every time you move, you sever all these connections. You have to start over again, and people don't realize what a toll that often takes on them.
Yeah.
Another happiness trap is the quest for prestige. We evolved; our minds are designed to win at the game of evolution, and part of that is gaining prestige, not gaining happiness. Evolution doesn't care whether or not you're happy. Evolution only rewarded those who were successful, and so often we will choose prestige. We will go for the harder job, the higher paying job, the more stressful job, the more prestigious job. And we tell ourselves that we'll be happy because we'll be more prestigious. But often it backfires. If you seek directly after wealth or directly after prestige, on average that backfires. Now, the rich are a little happier than the poor, so money does appear to help a little bit. Not a lot, but it does help a little bit. But if you're focused on the money, if you're thinking, oh, if I could just get more money, that kind of materialist mindset is at least correlated with less happiness.
You also talked a lot about the recent, and this is the, you know, a liberal-generated value of inclusivity And you use the term, you said it kind of cuts us off from what you call the soil of tradition.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've got risks if you exclude people and their differences, and you've got risks if you create a value system that says everything is kind of equal, and there's no point in a tradition.
That's what's fascinating about modern life is the liberals are right about some things, the conservatives are right about some things, and we really do need a balance. I'll just try to make that point clear, because it's a point that people may not have gotten just from our brief exchange.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea that we need, as I was saying before, but we need a hive. We need some thickness to our moral world. We need there to be some content, some tradition, some rules, some structure. But what do you do when suddenly you got people from all different places around the world coming together? For example, I'm Jewish, and I was raised in a town which was actually about 20 or 30% Jewish, so it wasn't such a small minority. And so in my time, when we were kids, we sang Christmas songs and Hanukkah songs.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Christmas decorations and Hanukkah decorations, and that's all fine. But sometimes, nowadays, it seems to be happening that since the age of political correctness, schools and towns and some parents don't want any of that. They say, we can't have anything if it's going to exclude someone. Someone might feel alienated, so let's mm-hmm. have none of that stuff. And that's a bad idea. Kids need this thickness. They need richness. They need traditions. So in our in the drive, especially of people who are very liberal, in the drive to be completely inclusive, you end up creating a kind of a bland world without much stuff in it, a world of unlimited freedom, but, not really much interest.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm Jewish and I'm actually an atheist, I'm perfectly comfortable with things like moments of silent prayer in school or even non-denominational prayer. If a town is very religious and they want to have some kind of prayer, not specifically to Jesus Christ, but if they want to have more structure, if they can do it in a way that isn't too exclusive, go ahead and do it. I think that the tendency we have now to thin things out ultimately backfires and makes it harder for people to find meaning and joy in life.
We're certainly hearing a lot of this in the hearings for the Supreme Court. People, this is a legal issue these days, and certainly some of the thoughts you have should be informing our legal discussion. You're listening to On Your Mind with Steve Franklin. We're talking to the author of The Happiness Hypothesis, Dr. Jonathan Haidt. We've got lines open, 454-0400 in St. Louis, our toll-free nationally, 877-920-WGNU. Please call in and talk. We'll be back for your calls or our discussion right after these messages.
Faster than light, if you want to. Speeding through the universe. Thinking is the best way to travel.
You might think it would be easy to spot a child that's having vision problems.
Here, kitty, kitty, kitty. Here, kitty.
Whoa.
But it's not always that obvious.
Hey, Kevin, toss me the remote, will you, buddy?
Sure, Dad. Oops.
In many cases, the symptoms of a child's vision problem might be more subtle. A tilting of the head, a tendency to daydream, or there may be no warning signs at all. Considering that 80% of all childhood learning happens through the eyes, it's clear that good reading skills, good grades, and good eyesight all go hand in hand. Yet eye doctors tell us that 1 in 4 children has a vision problem. Parents and teachers should know the warning signs of vision problems in children to ensure their kids are seeing clearly. For a list of telltale clues, go to checkyearly.com. That's checkyearly.com. A public service message from the Vision Council of America. And reading is fundamental.
Hi, this is Brett Rosen with Head Thumping Talk Radio on WGNU. Just letting you know that we are moving to a new time from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. every Thursday morning. Dedicated to making you mad or making you think since 1999.
Watching everything the engineer would move.